Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Big news on the international front this week as Russia invaded Georgia. At a press conference yesterday in the Rose Garden, President Bush firmly stated the U.S. position on Russia's move.
The United States of America stands with the democratically elected government of Georgia. We insist that the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Georgia be respected.
Earlier today in Beijing, U.S. swimmer Michael Phelps won his sixth gold medal. That's a record career total of 12 Olympic medals. He spoke about what it means to have more medals than any other Olympian.
The people who, you know, came before us and competed in the Olympic Games are some of the greatest athletes who ever lived. You know, to win the most gold medals is unbelievable. I just have no idea what to say.
And just released yesterday, new numbers on inflation. Rates in the U.S. have risen by 5.6% over the past year, the highest level since 1991.
Prices are up, and this has been, I think, the one thing that has just created this bearish market now for the last 6 months, is that we just can't wring inflation out of the system.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join our conversation. What's your top story this week? Have you been following the conflict between Russia and Georgia? Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Tony Blankley. He's a longtime journalist and a columnist for The Washington Times. Tony, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
With me also from New York City is Krista Freeland, U.S. Managing Editor for The Financial Times. Kristen, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Welcome to you, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Tony, and Kristen.
So this week began with Russian tanks pushing into Georgia. Krista Freeland, this is your area of expertise. Put this into perspective for us, this crisis.
Well, I think that this is a really, really major moment. I think that this is probably the biggest shift we've seen in Russian policy since 1989, since the fall of the Berlin Wall. This is the first time that we've seen Russia actually move its tanks, move its military onto the territory of a neighboring sovereign nation. So I think it's a really big deal, and I think that neither the United States nor Europe nor the countries closer to Russia, and I think we need to look particularly at Ukraine, have fully thought through how they're going to deal with and respond to this new, much more bellicose and much more dangerous Kremlin. Mm.
Let's hear Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She arrived in Georgia this morning, and that's after stopping in France yesterday to meet with French President Sarkozy. In a press conference, Rice said the conflict must end.
We will work very hard to see if we can bring an end to this crisis. It is long overdue. Too many innocent people have died, and Georgia, whose territorial integrity and independence and sovereignty we fully respect, must be able to get back to normal life.
And Defense Secretary Robert Gates held a news conference yesterday in Washington. He said he had no plans to use U.S. military against Russian troops.
The United States spent 45 years working very hard to avoid a military confrontation with Russia. I see no reason to change that approach today.
Tony Blankley, how do you see the U.S. response so far to Russia?
Oh, I think it has been a disgrace. Certainly in the early days, the flabbiness, the flat-footedness of the Bush administration, and I'm a conservative Republican, was shocking. They seemed to endorse Sarkozy's ceasefire proposal that didn't specifically protect Georgia's territorial integrity. And they've sort of been playing catch-up all week. The response is still less than adequate. But this has been a long time coming, because while we, since the fall of the Soviet Union, have been pushing our line between us and the Russians eastward, still trying to bring them into sort of the legitimate world, but pushing our line pretty vigorously eastward, we have not been keeping our military forces up, and Russia eventually was going to want to resist. Russia is the wrong, is the bad guy in this play, but the point is it was predictable what they would do. NATO spending on defense is down, all country average, to 1.8% of GDP. I think the strongest statement NATO could make right now is a firm commitment from all the countries of NATO to get to 3% of GDP for their defense spending. America's at 4% already. And prove that NATO intends to continue its responsibilities, its historic responsibilities, to not let Russian expansionism under any guise continue.
Mm. Before I get your take on this, Jack Beatty, let's listen to more sound from this week. Here's Georgia's president, Mikhail Saakashvili. He's speaking out on CNN. He had harsh words for Russia.
What we've been witnessing for the last days is a brutal, calculated, cold-blooded, premeditated murder by Russia of a small democracy on its borders.
And here's Russia's foreign minister speaking out about the United States' relations to Russia and Georgia. He said the U.S. must decide which side it is on. Here is translation by NPR's Gregory Pfeiffer.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Georgia is a special project of the United States. He said Washington would have to choose between its virtual project or real partnership with Russia.
Jack Beatty, appropriate responses from the U.S. to these particular statements?
Well, first, let's put it into some context. This Georgian leader has been encouraged by U.S. policy over the last few years in order to get another recruit to the coalition of the willing in Iraq. We have gone out of our way to get to, Georgia has sent people there, and in return, we have sent advisors to Georgia to beef up their, to train their military and so on. And we have encouraged this man to take a very adventurous position. I mean, to move in as they did last week into Ossetia. This provoked the Russians, and the Russians responded more or less as we would have if something like this had happened on the Mexican border. Great powers act this way in their sphere of influence. We had no business encouraging this country to do what it did. And the expansion, and the idea of expanding NATO to include this country on Russia's border was provocative in the extreme. In addition, in the spring, when we backed Kosovo's split from Serbia, the Russians warned us at the time, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you're going to do this with this separatist group, we're going to do it with our Ossetians, people who don't want to remain in Georgia. You know, turn the great powers behave. I mean, Thucydides laid it down millennia ago. The weak do the strong do what they will. The weak suffer what they must. That's the rule of our foreign policy and of all great power foreign policy on their borders, especially. And we've only to turn the clock back to 1846 and to see here we have a breakaway province of Mexico called Texas. The Texans said, no, we want to be part of the United States. The United States said fine. We sent an army into Mexico. We crushed Mexico and seized California into the bargain. So we had no business encouraging this country to take this kind of adventurous move.
So, Krista Freeland, jump in. Do you agree with Jack?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I'm afraid I strongly disagree with Jack. I don't usually, but on this I really strongly do. I think that it's really dangerous, as it was during the Cold War, to draw a moral equivalence between Russia and the United States and between Russia and Georgia in this case. Part of what is going on, a really important part of what is going on, which that Sergei Lavrov quote underscored, is Russian opposition specifically to democratically elected governments in the former Soviet space. These governments are extremely threatening to a neo-authoritarian Russian regime. That's why it's Georgia specifically, and if Ukraine were weaker, it would be Ukraine as well, that the Russians are really threatened by. And they're threatened because they don't like the idea of democracy in their neighborhood. They think that sets a really bad example for Russians. So this is not just a question of the chessboard. It's not just a question of realpolitik. It's a question of what kind of a world we think that we should be living in and what kind of a world we want the former Soviet space to become. Having said that, I do think that American policy towards Georgia has been miscalculated, because what we had was a lot of very strong words which turned out to have been backed by very little. And that was definitely a recipe for encouraging Saakashvili to act in ways which I don't think were wrong, but turn out to have been very rash.
Tony Blankley, so given that as a backdrop, where does this all go from here?
Well, I don't know where it goes. Let me just briefly say, when Jack said that Georgia provoked Russia, whatever one thinks of Georgia's action, this was something that had been a long time in the planning. And between Thursday and Friday, Russia did not assemble all of its forces. There are already good articles by military experts pointing out that the forces that were used came from thousands of miles away in Russia, had been carefully assembled in advance. You don't run something like this out of 48 hours of logistics plannings. So Russia was looking for an opportunity to make a point, and they've made the point in I think an emphatic way. I just have to say that the hero of the week, for me at least, is, as always, plucky Poland. In this week, with the Russians belligerently saying this is a message to other countries and warnings, Poland took yesterday as the day to accept American placement of anti-missile systems on their territory. And with all sorts of historic memories about the pluckiness of Poland, I would hope that the rest of Europe and Western Europe would have the courage that Poland displayed yesterday.
Yeah, but I'm afraid this too is a very ominous development for America. You know, back in the 90s when NATO was being expanded, George F. Kennan wrote that expanding NATO would be the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-war era, and I'm afraid that's being borne out daily.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week's top stories. With me today is Krista Freeland. She is U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times. Also with me, Tony Blankley, columnist for the Washington Times. And, of course, our own Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly and On Point News Analyst. Let's go to the phones. First up out of the break here and welcome some callers to our conversation. First up from Boston is Andy. Andy, welcome to On Point.
How are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
Well, I had a question. One of your guests said that he thought that George Bush's response was weak and was inappropriate, and he should have been more strong-armed. With all the fronts that we already have our military on, does it make sense for us to be heading any kind of negotiation or any kind of response to Russia? I mean, it doesn't really seem to make sense, considering that we're so dispersed already. And what would the appropriate response be?
Andy, thank you. Tony Blankley, that was your statement earlier.
Well,
why don't you respond now?
America and its president always have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. This is not, by the way, a military moment for us. So the fact that our army is stretched is not relevant. We do have the 6th Fleet with 175 combat planes within about, 48 hours steaming of the Black Sea. So we could move a little closer just to remind them that we're still around. But this is largely a matter of leading the European West in a clear set of messages that this is going, that Russia will pay increasingly high diplomatic and economic prices for this. And the initial messages, the reason I thought that Bush took about a week to get to what is now, I think, pretty close to the correct message, it was weak because it didn't initially assert that. It sounded even-handed. It didn't defend Georgia's territorial integrity. And it was very slow to get his Secretary of State out. She should have been out and working the capitals of Europe immediately, certainly by phone and probably in her presence. She didn't get to Paris until yesterday. And I think that was a lack of leadership from the White House.
Krista Freeland, do you agree? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the one thing, Tony touched on economic measures. I think that's an area that we haven't seen a lot of action on yet. And I think that that is really promising, because a difference between the Russia today and the Soviet Union of the Cold War period is this is a Russia which has been integrating very actively into the world economy. And it's a Russia whose wealthiest people have fabulous homes on the French Riviera, have fabulous homes on Fifth Avenue, have fabulous homes in London. And they have, you know, very wealthy Swiss bank accounts. So this is definitely a time when forceful economic measures applied in a very targeted way could send a message to Russia, and a message which, you know, doesn't require gunboats.
Mm. Here's another question on this point from listener Barbara, who is in Tiffin, Iowa. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi. Thank you. I wanted to ask, first of all, about national integrity. Did we care about the national integrity of Afghanistan or Iraq or Iran? And secondly, what has Russia got to lose in their relationship with us? What have we done for them besides break treaties, surround them with enemies, constantly criticize, constantly demand that they fix North Korea, that they fix Iran, that they do this and they do that, while we're letting them know always how inferior and no good that they are?
All right, Barbara, thank you. To the heart of your question, Krista Freeland, what does Russia have to lose in its relationship with the U.S. at this point?
Well, I think it's those economic points that I was talking about a moment ago. You know, what is really interesting and intriguing and will be sort of an interesting test, I think, of whether economic globalization, whether those trade ties, those connections between capital markets have a moderating force on this rising Russian nationalism. So Russia and Russian business stands to lose quite a lot if the relationship really sours.
Mm. Both John McCain and Barack Obama have spoken out this week about the Russian-Georgia crisis. Here's John McCain first up yesterday at a press conference in Michigan. He's come out strongly backing Georgia, and he says it's time to reevaluate world relationships with Russia.
We must address the future of the alliance's relationship with Russia, and with our G7 partners, we should discuss whether it makes sense for Russia to continue its participation in the G8.
And Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is on vacation this week, but one of his advisors, Susan Rice, appeared on MSNBC's Hardball. Here with guest host David Schuster, Rice says McCain's strong response to the Georgia-Russia conflict might have made the situation worse.
John McCain shot from the hip, very aggressive, very belligerent statement, and he may or may not have complicated the situation.
I'm not sure that John McCain supporters would agree with your characterization, but we're going to find out now. Susan Rice, thank you for coming on. We appreciate it.
Jack Rice, do you agree with Ms. Rice on this point?
Yes, I do. I mean, Pat Buchanan, with his gift for overstatement, said that McCain's behavior on this has made Dick Cheney look like Gandhi. You know, we know now that that McCain's main advisor on foreign policy, a man named Randy Scherneman, received since 2004 $800,000 in lobbying fees from Georgia. And what has Georgia been getting for that money? Well, they've been getting McCain's ear, for one thing. They've been getting McCain's sponsorship of a Nobel Peace Prize for the Georgian president for another. They've been getting, U.S. advisors and so on. So they've done very well on their $800,000. But it's a very extraordinary thing to have a presidential candidate with a lobbyist for a country that's involved in this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And McCain has consistently, even before this, going back into the spring, he put a gratuitous cut at Russia in a speech where he said, his advisor said, don't do this. There's no point in it. Why provoke them? He said, I want Russia out of the G8. And of course, people responded, if you do that, you're going to have a new Cold War. Well, that's exactly, I think, one of the things that's on the ballot this fall. We have from William Kristol, another one of his advisors, calling virtually for a U.S. war against Russia by proxy. We have another one, other of his advisors are invoking blaming Hitler and expansionism and so on. This is a very, you know, I think we got a clue here that a McCain presidency would be a very thrilling enterprise indeed.
Could I just jump in?
Sure, Krista, you may.
I was just going to say, I think it is a little bit unfair to Senator McCain to suggest that his policy on Georgia has been unduly influenced by this advisor. He has been consistently, many years before this specific conflict, he's been consistently a lot more suspicious of Russia and a lot stronger in his support of the new democracies in the former Soviet Union, really, than any other American senator. So it's not that he's swerved his line. And I also think that we really have to be careful if we think that a strong line like the one taken by Senator McCain this week is somehow pushing Russia over the brink. Russia is over the brink already. Russia has said, this is how we are going to be. We are going to be aggressive. We are going to project our force into what we consider to be our sphere of influence. And the question for the West is not, you know, if we're nice and say nice things to the Russians and let them stay in the G8, will that make them softer? The question is, how are we going to respond and how far are we going to consent to the projection of Russian force outside of Russia's borders?
Tony, I hear you want to jump in.
Yeah, just a little election assessment. I think that while all the players have been making their points this week, if the average voter watching the news casually, they've seen, I think, McCain performing ably and Obama pretty minimally. In fact, if you look at the statements both from the White House, from McCain, and from Obama over the week, you see both Obama and McCain and the White House moving towards the positions that McCain enunciated right at the beginning. I think this has been a good week for him. The question that I've talked to some Democratic operatives the last day or two in Washington, why hasn't Obama come out more? And some think he should have either truncated his vacation or been out more. Others think that maybe he's... prudence is a better part in this one, and he's sort of letting McCain get his week because he doesn't want to get into a lot of press conversations on that topic. I don't know what the calculation in the Obama camp was, but I think unquestionably this has been a good week for McCain on this topic.
Let me make a turn from the candidates to their conventions at this point, because both sides are certainly gearing up. Let's begin with the Democrats, because it's been announced this week that former Virginia Governor Mark Warner will deliver the keynote address in Denver, and Senator Hillary Clinton's name will be placed in nomination at the convention. Tony Blankley, what's the significance of that, and what are the logistics of that?
Well, obviously, I'm not a great fan of either Hillary or Obama, but I think, and I've worked on managing Republican convention message matrices in the past, and I think that Obama has given away too much. He's the winning candidate. He's got Monday through Thursday where he controls every image and every word that comes out. You control the teleprompter. You control everything that happens within the convention. And I think he's given them, the Clintons, too much time. He's allowed her to have her own production company put up her own presentation of herself. He's giving away two of the 4 days to Clintons. I think that's just a technical mistake. I'm sure he's going to give a brilliant speech Thursday night, and it'll be a wonderful conclusion. But if I had been him, I think I would have been tougher with the Clintons. The Clintons will roll over anybody who doesn't push back.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Does this moment give delegates a chance to support her on the floor through a roll call vote? I mean, that makes for an interesting moment at the convention, huh?
It does, and it's fitting. I mean, she got, 18 million votes? And, you know, his first priority is to heal the party. This is a gesture and a very significant one in that direction. And I think it's, and interestingly, apparently it came from the Obama camp. Hillary hadn't even been asking for it, from what I've read. So I think it's a very good move on his part, and I'm sure some network people will say, oh, my gosh, there's divisions in the Democratic Party. But I think that'll be more apparent than real.
Krista Freeland, two front-running vice presidential candidates emerging this week, Senator Joe Biden and, of course, Evan Bayh. We've heard about him. They are slated to speak at the convention. Tell us how you think the vice presidential picks may be lining up. On Democratic side first.
Well, obviously, that is one of the cards that Barack Obama still has. I tend to agree with Tony that I'm a little bit surprised at how much Obama and his people have given way to the Clintons, and particularly on that roll call vote. Hillary Clinton actually had been, I think, in quite a questionable way, agitating her supporters to push for this. There's a great bit of YouTube video from a Palo Alto fundraiser she did at the end of July where she was essentially sort of egging on her backers to push for a roll call vote. And one of the backers there even said at this meeting, well, Hillary, you know, what if you come out as the winner after that vote? So I don't think that this is as safe a move for Senator Obama as some people might. Mm-hmm. Having said that, an interesting card that he has to play is choosing his vice president or his vice presidential running mate. And that definitely, you know, that's a moment of drama. If he picks someone really good and really exciting, maybe that takes a little bit of the spotlight off the Clintons. I think Biden and Evan Bayh would both be good candidates in that they give Obama some of that, you know, experience, particularly with Biden on foreign policy, that he is perceived to lack. But what I would really be excited by would be if we had a candidate from out of left field, say even someone as exotic as Mike Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm. Tony Blankley, turn us to the Republicans for a moment. How's the GOP convention shaping up?
Well, it doesn't have the drama of the Democratic convention, of course. You know, McCain has the challenge of being a gadfly leading a party that doesn't much like him. and he's got a decision to make on the vice presidential choice, neither of which are good. He doesn't have a good choice. He either goes to the center with someone to appeal to the independent votes, which he desperately needs to be competitive in if he wants to have a chance of winning, which might be a pro-abortion person like Ridge or even Senator Lieberman. But then he deflates what little energy there is in the Christian conservative right of his party. If, on the other hand, he goes with a true blue conservative, he undermines his ability to reach to the center. I think if I were him, I'd try to find the blandest candidate I could find. I tend to think that vice presidential choices are usually either negative or neutral. They don't really add much, usually. Once in a while, you can find an example. Lyndon Johnson helped Kennedy because he carried Texas. I don't think that really happens that much anymore.
Tony, do you think that McCain's age changes that a little bit?
Well, his age is an issue. I worked on Ronald Reagan's campaign. The age was an issue for Ronald Reagan. Interestingly, the way Reagan handled his age issue, not only in the joke about taking advantage of youth and inexperience, but earlier on, he paced himself so he always seemed energetic when he was on camera. McCain's doing the opposite. He's proving he's 35 years old by campaigning 14 hours a day, which I think is a bad tactical decision. He is, in fact, a vigorous man. But, yeah, no, I don't think that he needs to... I don't know. I mean, if he picks somebody too young, then perhaps it's an issue. As long as he picks somebody who's at least a governor and 45 years old, I don't think the age factor plays much.
Before we go to break here, I want to get another piece of news in this week. John Edwards admitted to an affair with a campaign worker. Here's an excerpt from that interview with ABC News correspondent Bob Woodruff.
In 2006, 2 years ago, I made a very serious mistake, a mistake that I am responsible for, and no one else. In 2006, told Elizabeth about the mistake, asked her for her forgiveness, asked God for his forgiveness.
Jack Beat, about a minute left here before our break. Does this news in any way tarnish the Democratic Party, in any way hurt Barack Obama?
I can't imagine that it does. You know, I heard a word this week I'm glad to hear. Franklin Roosevelt used to use it a lot. The word is cad. This man is a cad. In that same interview, he went on to say, now I want it clear that this affair began when Elizabeth was in remission. I mean, think of that.
Yeah. Tony Blankley, would you jump in?
Yeah, look, obviously it's a personal disgusting act, not a party act or an ideological act. The only danger, and it's a minimal one, to the Democrats is if the story continues, if he hasn't told the truth, which probably he hasn't, when are the next little explosions going to occur? I would assume if I were the Obama people, I'd want to get everything out right away, not have some, you know, National Enquirer release a story on the Monday of his convention, then again on the Thursday of some new revelation. I'm not predicting anything, but already we're getting little words that he knew about some money being transferred. So he's going to be a distraction, and you just don't know when they're going to pop off. But I don't think it's not that he doesn't have a strategic impact on negatively on Obama.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Lots to talk about this week in the news. Here are some other things. Last Friday's Olympic opening ceremonies won big praise. China had everything perfect. Too perfect, perhaps. Turns out the voice of that little girl singing Ode to the Motherland was not that of the smiling 9-year-old Ling Miaoke, captured on TV around the world. Instead, it was the voice of 7-year-old Yang Peiyi. She was off stage singing, deemed not pretty enough to be on camera. And Julia Child is probably best known for bringing French cuisine into America's kitchens. But yesterday, the National Archives released documents showing that Julia Child doubled as a U.S. spy, working for the OSS in China and Sri Lanka in the 1940s. Will this famous voice ever sound the same?
We're roasting Miss Chicken today on The French Chef.
And 65-year-old soul icon Isaac Hayes died last Sunday in Memphis, Tennessee. He won an Oscar for the theme song from the 1971 film Shaft.
Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man?
Shaft!
Can you dig it?
So, let's turn to U.S. economic news for a moment. U.S. inflation reached a 17-year high last month, fueled by high gas prices, high food prices. More bad news for the U.S. economy. Krista Freeland, put this into perspective for us. What does this mean in the broader context?
Well, it is bad news. And what is particularly difficult about the inflation number is it comes at a time when unemployment has also been growing. So we are looking at an unpleasant possibility of stagflation. Remember that?
Yeah.
The other thing which I think is going to be a real headwind for the U.S. for the rest of this year is we are now seeing something we had been talking about for the past 12 months, which is contagion. You know, there was a big question when the credit crunch began about whether the weakness in the U.S. would spread to the rest of the world, and it looked for a while as if it wouldn't. And so there was this real hope that the rest of the world would be quite economically strong. That would help buoy up the U.S. We've seen a little bit of that. U.S. exports have been remarkably strong, and that's part of the reason that the U.S. economy hasn't slowed down as much as some people had expected. But now the other shoe is dropping, particularly in Europe. It looks as if in the second quarter of this year, the European economy actually contracted. Mm. So That is going to mean some more difficulties for the U.S., and I think that could have big implications for the election.
Are you talking about Europe flirting with some sort of recession? Is that what you're pointing
well,
to?
Well, yeah, the technical definition of recession is if you have two quarters of economic contraction. So they have one quarter, and we'll see what happens in the third quarter. Mm. They could well be in recession.
Tony Blankley, what's your take?
Well, I mean, she's got it, of course, right. There aren't obvious paths to recovery because we have a different situation than we've had in the past in the world. For instance, normally when the American economy slows down, the demand for oil goes down, the demand for copper, all the elements of production go down, and you get a But instead, because of China and the East continuing to expand, you see them pulling the prices up even while our economic activity is going down. So we don't get at least the side benefit of a contracting of economy of a reduction in prices. Instead, we're seeing inflation advance. And I think it's interesting looking at the two candidates talking about economy. Neither of them, I think, have found a compelling message, perhaps because there's no obvious solution. I don't know that raising taxes or protectionism, which sort of, to a little bit overcharacterize Obama's position, is his, makes a lot of sense in a contracting economy. But McCain, likewise, other than simply saying let's keep tax rates down, he doesn't have much to say. And so the central issue for a lot of voters in the campaign is not being centrally addressed by either candidate. It's curious.
Do you agree with that, Jack Beatty?
Well, I think that the inflation numbers mean this. Real wages are falling. That's what inflation means. And that can't be good news for John McCain. We've just come through a recovery in which the average American family lost $1,000 during the recovery. Now we're going down into the trough, and we have a slowing economy and inflation, real wages falling. That is not, it loads the economic dice strongly against McCain.
Let me just add there.
Sure, Tony.
I completely agree that the economy ought to be working badly against McCain, but the polls show the public roughly even on who they trust. I think Obama's got like 4 or 5 point advantage. He should have a 15-point advantage on that issue.
Hey, Jack, you had some interesting poll numbers related to the campaign as well. What are they?
Well, it's just the projections from pollster.com, which collates all the polls and then projects, what the state of things are. And in their current rundown of electoral votes, they have Obama at 284 and McCain at 154. 284, of course, is 14 more than you need to be elected. So, if the election were held today, that's where they think things would wind up. And by the way, that closely tracks that margin, the predictive model of Ray Fair, the Yale economist who measures the econometrics of elections. And on our show earlier this year, he came about there in predicting a Democratic victory.
I've also, Jack, been looking at pollster.com, and I noticed that too. I think what's interesting is sometimes when we talk about the polls, we talk about the overall national number when we compare McCain and Obama. And an interesting detail behind those numbers has been in some of the important states, and as it happens, these are some of the states where the economic slowdown is hitting the hardest, we've actually seen Obama performing really strongly.
Tony, quickly.
Yeah, that poll has Florida, Virginia, Indiana, and Montana as toss-up states. If those are really toss-up states by November, it's going to be a landslide for Obama. I don't think those are toss-up states.
I want to turn quickly to Pakistan for a moment because Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf, of course, an important ally of the United States, is expected to resign in the next few days rather than face impeachment charges. Krista Freeland, how might that development affect Pakistan and then more broadly the region?
Well, it, I think, is the right thing for Pakistan. I think that we've seen a lot of protests against Musharraf, a lot of missteps by Musharraf. So, there's a good reason that he's doing this. Having said that, I think it throws into question another really volatile part of the world, particularly since, I think quite rightly, we've seen a lot of shift in focus from Iraq to looking at what's happening in Afghanistan. So I think it's another troubling variable. And, Tony said American presidents need to walk and chew gum at the same time. Well, they're going to probably have to be bouncing a basketball while they're doing that with Pakistan, Iraq, and now needing to worry about what to do with Russia.
Tony Blankley?
Well, the Pakistani government, since its birth at the demise of the British Raj, has been a deformed governance. It has attempted to be democratic. It has really been run largely by the military and the intelligence services, and it has been a sort of a very powerful families having undue influence on the political process. And we've tried to make Pakistan our ally more often than not, and we've probably gained over the decades more from Pakistan's governance than we've lost. And we've gained over the last 5 years. They have obviously been the key place. We can't fight in Afghanistan without driving our equipment up from Pakistan. So managing the Pakistani ruling regime is always a challenge. So far, it's been done pretty well, and we'll see after Musharraf whether we can continue to influence it.
Let's bring some callers into this conversation. We have a couple on the line. Elaine is in Simsbury, Connecticut. First up, Elaine, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Yes.
I was wondering if your commentators could talk about the new abomination from the Republican machine called Obama Nation, a polemic that apparently deals in half-truths, lies, et cetera. And I just wonder why the Republicans can't win an election based on the merits instead of this kind of tactic.
Elaine, thank you. Actually, before we go to our panelists, let's hear from the author of that book. It's called Obama Nation, Leftist Politics and the Cult of Personality. Jerome Corsi also wrote the book Unfit for Command about Senator John Kerry in 2004. Here's Corsi garnering much criticism, actually, for that book. But he's appearing on CNN's Larry King this week.
So I'm out front, just as I was with co-authoring Unfit for Command with John O'Neill. Here I'm saying clearly I oppose Barack Obama, and the book is designed to lay this information out and let the American public decide.
Tony Blankley, what do you know about this book? And you hear the caller.
I have not read the book yet. I will, I hope, over this weekend. I read his former book that he co-authored with O'Neill, and there was a lot of truth in there, and there was some information that wasn't correct. I mean, the Cambodian excursion of Kerry was true. The number of things. So you have to go carefully to see what's correct and not. But every election cycle has a lot of books coming out on both sides, inevitably, that paint the picture darkly for the opposing candidate. The Democrats have plenty of books coming out. They've got this latest one by Susskind out. So there's always going to be a lot of this going on. It's not one party that stands for truth and the other that is malignant. Both parties push out information, and it's up to the voters to read and assess objectively.
Jack Beatty, this is a book that will debut number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Go ahead, give it a whack.
Well, that's partly a manufactured number as it comes out. We know that conservative book clubs help to buoy the numbers of a book by buying on bulk so that you get a kind of bandwagon effect. And then, of course, he goes on right-wing media and spouts his misrepresentations. You know, and, of course, we have Mary Matalin as his editor who says, this is a scholarly book. That's an interesting comment. And, you know, one of the claims that really got me was he claims Obama was in the church when Reverend Wright made one of his most incendiary sermons. And, in fact, he was in Florida. Bill Kristol had written that, and it said, oops, I'm sorry. The record said he was in Florida. So what does Corsi say? Well, Kristol has taken Obama's part on this. I think from what evidence is he operating other than his sheer, unballasted, paranoiac, and highly profitable prejudice?
Go ahead, Krista.
No, I was just going to say, Jane, I think that Tony is being far too modest on behalf of the Republican Party. I think Republicans are much better at this kind of thing than Democrats. Republicans are much better at negative campaigning, and they've been really good. I think they've been remarkably effective just as a pure the pure practice of the political dark arts. They've been remarkably effective at narrowing and zeroing in on Obama's key political vulnerability and really hammering away at it. And that vulnerability, which I think people close to Obama in the Democratic camp will also concede is the big question for them, is for all his strengths as a charismatic politician, for all the advantages the Democrats have this year, that is a weak economy, an unpopular incumbent president, an unpopular war, Barack Obama still hasn't closed the deal with the American people in terms of giving them a comfortable sense of who he is as a person, a comfortable sense of his Americanness. And, you know, that's why this book, I think, is dangerous.
Tony Blankley, respond.
Just just to point out, in 2004, for one example, there was this circuit where anti-Bush books came out. They were published. Then the author went on, usually on 60 Minutes, and all of them were bestsellers in their time, and they were timed to come out for the campaign. That's the Democratic formula, because they control most of publishing house. Not all. There are some conservative houses, and they publish conservative books. But both parties have the capacity and willingly use the capacity to bring negative information out into the media in an election cycle.
Let's round out this hour with the Olympics. To Beijing, Michael Phelps, a huge story this week. 6 gold medals so far and a career total of 12 gold medals, the most decorated Olympian in history. I open it to the panel. What do you make of this achievement? It's not over yet. Tony Blankley?
Well, I admire athletes, not being one myself. I admire most of all the amount of training it must take to get to that point of physical fitness. I'm also not a physical fitness person. I generally don't like the Olympics, and I don't follow them, and I admire the athletes and their dedication.
And yet, NBC says these games, a lot of people are following them. They're on pace to be the most watched Olympics ever. 157 million viewers have watched at least some part of the coverage of these games. Krista Freeland?
For me, it's really inspiring. You know, these are quite dark times, both in terms of what's happening in geopolitics, what's happening in the economy. As Jack was saying earlier, that economic weakness is reflected for a lot of people in, you know, problems balancing your family budget. And I think that seeing, you know, these examples of real personal achievement, I think it's really fun.
Are you watching, Jack Beatty?
No, I really regard the Olympics as a nationalistic, atavistic spectacle, also a capitalistic one with all the ads. But here's the one thing. I see that Michael Phelps has a diet of 12,000 calories a day. Before I leave this earth, I want to try that.
What I think you have to swim 8 hours a day.
I want to do it.
That's the catch.
Oh, darn.
Krista, what do you make of China and the way it's presenting itself in these games so far?
Well, I think that China has been overshadowed by Russia this week. I think the Chinese must be really shaking their heads. The Russian comrades have done it again to them. I think that it hasn't gone badly for China. There could have been, it was possible that this could have been a PR disaster for China, you know, and it's not over yet. But, you know, imagine there had been some sort of pro-democracy or pro-Tibet or pro-Uyghur protest, which was brutally crushed by the Chinese police. But I think neither has it been the sort of triumphant welcome of a democratizing China into the community of nations, which maybe the Olympic Committee expected when they awarded the games to China.
Mm. Yeah, on that point, I was in China about a month ago, and my sense is that whatever it hasn't accomplished internationally, the enthusiasm that I found from the Chinese I spoke with regarding then the upcoming Olympics, I think it did have a very positive effect internally on many Chinese.
Mm. My thanks to this panel today for a really interesting and thoughtful conversation. Tony Blankley, columnist for The Washington Times. I appreciate your time, Tony. Thanks.
Thank you.
Krista Freeland, U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. Krista, nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane. I enjoyed it.
And Jack Beatty, Senior Editor of the Atlantic Monthly and On Point News Analyst. Have a good weekend, Jack. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.